So I think that's it. Nothing more is needed. Just exactly what's happening now. No need to look for something more. So is something missing? We have spoken quite a lot those last evenings, and I thought maybe there are a few things which are not so clear. So tonight I would like to open it to questions. But usually I really don't like question and answer evening, for one reason, because often it goes in so many directions that we really don't go deep into any topic, but we just cover such a vast field and just stay on the surface of the questions. So I would rather like the question to be centered on our practice and also on our doubts. Yet I have spoken yesterday and maybe even some other evening about a few things, and I have to take the responsibility also to answer the question relating to those topics. It would not be nice to start to speak about something and then say, I don't want question about it, because it's not related with what we are doing. So if you have any question, I'll try to answer. Yes?
I think in the first evening about Vipassana and religion.
Yes. So what would you like to?
Then you would explain the relationship. Why cannot you return to Vipassana without religion? That's what you said. To get an example.
Yes. Yes, I spoke, I think maybe the second evening, about the honesty, from my point of view, to express the context of what we are doing in Buddhist term, for one reason. First is that I have no pretension to have discovered anything on my own. I have received from many teachers, that one aspect. And the other, I think it's quite dishonest to speak about something and not mention it. So if I would come here and speak for many evenings about Buddhism and in disguise never mentioning it, like if I was not speaking about it, yet all the point of view which are explained and expressed are really the Buddhist point of view. That's why I thought it's much better to say what it is, that people can protect themselves against it if they wish. That suddenly they don't think that modern way of thinking, that scientific way of thinking, well, it is really the Buddhist tradition. So I think as a matter of honesty, it's important. Now, the danger to see Vipassana just as a technique, then one may forget the whole aspect of the practice, which is not only just a technique of meditation, but it also refers to a way of behaving, some ethical code of behavior, and also to the dimension that Patricia also explained in the Metta meditation. So Vipassana is one aspect, but our spiritual practice is vaster than just Vipassana. And the danger would be, and sometimes I think it is taken in this sense in some country, that it becomes some kind of very subtle psychotherapy, spiritual psychotherapy, and forgetting that it does require from us a little bit more than that. And that may be taken from the Buddhist background or from any other spiritual background. In many courses we have people from different religious traditions coming, And I think that's very important to see that they can find within their own tradition, their framework, to give a meaning to the technique. But it's not just coming to some kind of mindfulness technique or therapy to solve some problem and be a little bit more spacious. That's my point of view. Not because I think there is some danger avoiding the issue of speaking about religion. Often people ask me if Buddhist is a religion. So when they ask that, they have in mind either they would like it not to be a religion or they would like it to be a religion. Different point of view. For some it's not a religion, so we don't like religion. Buddhism is not a religion, that's fine. So, and for some other, they look for a religion, so at least Buddhism should be a religion. Well, it doesn't matter so much, actually. Yet, if one says it is not a religion, then one tends to where one would put that. Is it just some kind of philosophy, or is it some kind of, again, of therapeutic tools? I think in the Buddhist tradition, one has to see that it is in the country where it is lived by the people of the country, it has all the aspects of religion. It has temples, it has monks, and it has rituals, and all the aspects. Otherwise, would we say that it is a philosophy with monks, priests, temples, and rituals? So it doesn't make too much sense. The term religion is very difficult to be precise because it depends from which language it is taken. And in the West, usually it's, of course, much based on the Judeo-Christian tradition, where the sense of religion is connected to the sense of one God. And, of course, we are much influenced by that, and as soon as there is no God, we have to understand the word religion in a slightly different way. So that's fine. Yes? About skillful actions. I think I mentioned in the Four Noble Truths, I think briefly at the end, this wheel that the Buddha set in motion, which is symbolized the teaching that he started, including three aspects. The rim outside, which is morality, then the hub in the center, which is concentration, and the spokes, which is wisdom. So those three go together for a spiritual path to be healthy and complete. So the hub, with morality and a proper set of behavior, is seen in the Buddhist tradition. According to the state of mind in the one who is acting and the state of mind in the one who will be receiving the action. And if the state of mind of oneself and other will be more clear, more happy, then it is seen as a proper act, something that should be cultivated. If on the contrary that brings more confusion and suffering within myself and within other people, then that should be avoided. So that's the guideline, and as I said the other evening, it's possible that some action may be at some time a proper action and not at another time. It's not a very rigid guideline. If we see again the practice of Vipassana just as a technique and nothing is coming out in our daily behavior here or outside of the retreat, then again it's just a technique. We could be some subtle train in some subtle kind of dancing, because there's not much movement here, but yet it will be just completely confined in one type of activity. The morality will help our practice, because morality also requires some amount of mindfulness. Not to harm others will require from us to be aware of what we are doing, our motivation, and the consequence of what we are doing. So that is helping. The practice and all the spiritual paths is also included in that. Does it answer your question? Yes. Okay. So I'm glad you understood all what has been said for those 4 days. Yes?
The word is about the difference between the awareness meditation and concentration.
Mm-hmm. The way we are practicing it here, they are combined. But sometimes they are practiced clearly at a different time. I remember the time I spent in Thailand, and I traveled with a Tibetan monk. So we traveled and slept in different monasteries in north of Thailand. And we went in a monastery, and there were two monks, one young one and one old one, and that was the father and the son. And they had heavy discussion. One was saying, no, concentration is really the practice one should do, and the other, I don't remember which sense it was, the other said, oh no, vipassana, and that's the practice one should really do, the other is useless. So I imagine sometimes in the East, there is some kind of maybe monastery which will be specialized in one development, need of concentration. I have seen some teachers really very skillful at teaching concentration, and maybe some other at vipassana. But the way we practice here, it is combined. Now the attitude is slightly different, because when one aims at developing concentration, one chooses one object and the mind will stay focused on that only one object. And it can be of many different types. It can be on circle of colors, white disc for example, or red disc, or it may be a candle, a sound, anything, or it can be also our breathing. That can be an object for the development of concentration. There are many. Can be the space, can be consciousness, or there can be love and kindness, compassion, joy and equanimity. All those, they are object of focus on which the mind can just settle and forgetting all other perception, thoughts or emotions, just choosing that. So whenever something else is arising, one will be pushing it away by a way of getting more close in connection with the object one has chosen. So it's really to place the mind in one on one object, forgetting all other things, is a way to withdraw the mind. One is withdrawing the mind from all the other possibilities. Just to say, I make it much more simple, just choosing that only possibility. So when dealing with obstacles, distractions, one usually pushes them away to get back to the object. And that will be very helpful to develop a very strong mind. When the mind develops this quality of concentration, then if one want to use it after that and direct it for example to questioning or to inquiring, then the mind is very sharp. They give an example in the tradition. They say it is like sharpening an axe. It needs to be very sharp, and then wisdom will be the knowledge of where you will place your axe when you will maybe cut a tree. So you will know where to hit, but you need a very sharpened axe. If it is not sharpened, then you cannot really cut the tree. So the concentration will give this power of mind really to be concerned and dealing only with one object or experience at a time. The development of vipassana or insight is different. It's not so much, it will require an amount of quietness. If the mind is going in so many directions, then the development of vipassana or insight will not also be possible. But there, what one is developing is an intimacy with different experiences, whatever may arise, to know the nature of it. The first one is to bring the mind to a stable position, The second one, vipassana, is one will aim at developing wisdom, knowing the object. If you wish, let's take awareness of breathing. The first aspect will be to bring the mind to be very quiet. Just be dealing with the sensation of the breath. Now vipassana on that will be to realize the nature of the physical sensation. Here the nature will be of changing, of being not stable, and having no concrete reality. There we see how they are joined together. First to be on the breath, and then to see deeply the nature of the experience. Is it clear?
Not the last one clear. The last subject comes to the answer suddenly. And then
when you see the nature, I think that what I spoke about last night, I want to say a few words again, if you wish. By seeing the nature of the physical sensation there, which we experience as a movement of the breath, by seeing the nature clearly, then the mind will not grasp at it, because the mind will see there is nothing that one can grasp at. There is no quality in the breath or in the physical sensation. There is no quality which can be grasped. And when this grasping is let go of, then at this time there is a cessation of grasping, which is a cessation of conditioning. And again, all the meditation technique in the Buddhist tradition, and it may be also in many other ones, although I don't have the proper word from them to quote them, the only aim is at non-grasping. And why we need to be so close to our experience, because when we are distracted, in sense, it is because we are grasping. If there would be no grasping, there would be no distraction. We are grasping at those thoughts. That's why we go away. We are grasping at the noise. So our distraction, they are all the play of grasping. So if there is no grasping, we could imagine that there will be also sounds arising and all that. There will be no distraction. So all the technical, in technical terms or point of view, is not to grasp. Yes?
I want to ask about the practical aspects. How do non-grasping and having family, children, and relationships come together? Because you need to make a commitment. And you cannot, I cannot, let go of people so easily and not grasp and not cling to and have no attachment to people, very, very close people.
You say, how can they come together? So you suppose they can come together.
Well, the teachings are the teachings of non-grasping. I mean, there are families in this world and there will be children. So
yes.
Won't be Buddhist children anymore?
But it's not that all Buddhists are not grasping.
Yeah.
Okay, that's certainly a very important matter. But I think it's also point out at a very specific attitude of the Buddha and in the Buddhist tradition. When we read his text, most of the time he's speaking to monks. Even the text of Satipatthana Sutra, he's speaking to the monks. When the mind of a monk is clouded by desire, and it seems really that the Buddha was concerned, and only concerned, with suffering and the end of suffering. And what he speaks is, if you want to get rid of suffering, of the deepest suffering of birth and death, then that's the path leading to. He never, I don't know, he gives so many teachings, but I don't think he gave never any indication about organization of the life of the people. just a guideline, etiquette guideline, but he said to the monk, don't mix up with the wedding. The monk should not start to, arrange people to put them together, because he knows that there will be some problem after that. And that was not the proper way of dealing of the monk. Their job was really to see the truth of suffering and the cessation of it. And in a sense, in other religious tradition, there is answering to many more aspects of the life of the people. Organization, wedding, and all that, even divorce, that is taken care of by religion, not in the Buddhist tradition. It seems that in most of the other religion tradition, there are small group of people who really inquire into the depths of the truth, how to experience it. There are the mystics, or every tradition, they have their own small amount of people. That's not the average. So in the religion you have a vast amount of people believing, practicing more or less. We know all the seriousness of that, some people or less for some other. And among the group of people you have a few who try to go deep into the experience and think what is beyond the concept, what is beyond the attachment. And they are looking for that. And they may be monk or they may be celibate or not, according to the different traditions. That's fine. So it's really reserved in most of the tradition for a small group of people who really are stubborn in their looking for a deeper truth, the experience of it, not just reading books. If we see in many of the traditions, like in the Islamic tradition, many of the Sufi were killed because they were expressing things in a way that did not accord with the trend of the religious tradition. In the Christian tradition also, some of the deepest mystics were burned. Bring some wood and they were burned in Paris and all over Europe because of their expression of something deeper which did not accord with general way of seeing the world. They were expressing something which is beyond form and beyond conditioning. Even some of the deepest, they had problem with the general organization of religion. Now it seems that the Buddha really, or in the Buddhist tradition, the path is really the path of meditation and the path of morality and the path of concentration, but it's not seen that one could follow the path without practicing meditation. And all the aim is to reach a state which is beyond conditioning. So the ambition is very big, and it seems that in Buddhist tradition, there the Buddha and the teachers are really concerned with that aspect more than the aspect of organization of daily life, if we accept the aspect of morality. So that's one side of the question, to see how sometimes in Buddhist tradition we may sense a lack of something. But maybe more happening at another less deep level of concern. Now it seems that among the teacher of meditation in different countries, like in Southeast Asia or in Tibet and in Japan, some of the highest master were married and had family. It seems that is not in itself something that would be a contradiction. So they will certainly behave in a certain way, but if I would imagine the wife or husband of this teacher will really require this kind of very specific attachment that one feels maybe worthy of it, maybe there would be some disappointment. Because there will be certainly some kind of relationship, kind of openness and kindness, but there will be not the attachment that sometimes we also require from the other. It certainly will be a different way of seeing a family and a relationship. But it can be a beautiful way, a more open way, if one is ready, and hopefully the men and the women are ready in the same exploration. Do you have more question about that? Because I spoke a little bit on the side of it.
Yeah, I just wonder about all of us that are not, most of us are not monks and... No, we're not monks and nuns, and I mean, do we try to dance in two weddings at the same time? Because we're not here to just practice relaxation or something. And if you want to go for it, so I truly wonder if it's possible to like have normal life, or not normal, but to have life with other people, with relationships, with commitments, with jobs, and yet to practice meditation in the most serious and sincere way.
Yes, no doubt. Many people are doing it, and there is, on this aspect there is no contradiction, on the contrary. In Burma, at the time, I think the great teacher Ubakin, who was a teacher of Goenka, he was working in the Burmese government, the previous government, not this one, and he said he had a lot of responsibility. So he had many ministries, so he had to deal with so many questions, and in his office many people would come and require his signature to go on with some project. And he said he had such a concentration, he would just take a file, look at it, and ask some correction and send it away. In the morning we'll go to his meditation center for 1 or 2 hours, guide his students, and go back to his work. So there's no contradiction. On the contrary, I would imagine that people with some amount of mindfulness and the more freedom are needed in this world. It's very important. So there will be a proper behavior, and that will be influencing our world. And it's possible some people are really practicing within their context of daily life, saving some time for retreat and then practicing. It's not a contradiction.
Okay, I don't want to take
more time. I just want to say a few more things, because it's very important, I think, maybe a question that many of us may have here. And I think it's also not that we do practice and suddenly something is completely broken, like some grasping is broken, and that then suddenly we are completely a different person without any connection. It's rather that, as I explained the other evening, this white clothes that we want to dye dark blue, and we dip it and then it's become very light blue, then we have to do it many times, which also allow an adjustment in our life. That we will practice and have some development of some clarity, and then our life will be organized also on the base of this clarity, and then maybe practice a bit more, think more clearly, and that will be organized, I think, step by step. Not that there will be suddenly a shock, unless we are completely doing something which is not appealing to us. Yes?
How to let go. I think it's in both places, in life and in practice. When there is something wrong, something bad, we know this bad one. How can you let go? There is a strong attachment. And even in practice, when you have a bad emotion, it's okay when it's neutral, or when good emotion brings smile or faith, but when it's bad, something back
on
the time. How do we get
away
of it without aversion?
Yes. The way it works is by seeing it clearly. When we see clearly the nature of it, then naturally we'll let go of it. Okay, so that's the whole game, to see the nature of it. As I explained the other night, how with concept, like the concept of duration, we are adding something. And then when we start to see what we are adding to a situation, slowly we see the nature. I can explain something quite simple. For example, the changing nature. And when we see the changing nature of something very clearly, then this movement to grasp at it has no more sense, because we know it's changing completely. There is nothing that can be grasped there. So I think that's really by seeing clearly the situation, and that doesn't mean that one must have the deepest realization to see this very, very subtle change in the phenomena. But this way of seeing that things are changing, that may happen at many levels. And then one sees that clearly, for example, then one let go of it. It's one aspect. So in the practice, there is often some few aspects why we don't let go of some emotion or something like that. Because we may stay at some distance. And in this staying at some distance of the emotion, then we are not really experiencing them. By not experiencing them, we don't know them well. By not knowing them well, we can't let go of them. We are at some distance. And this, being at distance of the emotion, keeps some tension. And then it's difficult to let go of it. So, to let go requires some amount of courage to experience them. While we don't let go, most of the time, there is an avoidance of it. We try to avoid, and sometimes we come closer, but there is still some amount of avoidance. Then you stay there. Do you want to be more precise in the practice? Okay. Yes.
I wanted to ask about the relationship in the practice between the concentration and mindfulness and the development of love and compassion, and about the relationship between vipassana and the metta practice, because in my experience that I've seen sometimes people practicing concentration very deep, like in Goenka's courses, sometimes they seem a bit, you know, acting a bit like robots after that, because there's so much concentration that there's no space for openness and kindness of the heart, and sometimes it feels that this metta practice is like put on like a cap that doesn't fit the vipassana. It's like something completely different that is there to fill the space that the vipassana is so concentration, and you keep saying that the aim is non-grasping, and you keep emphasizing that. So where's the love and compassion if that is the only aim? If there's a life of total non-grasping, it could be very cold and if this metta practice is there to feel that hope, so it sometimes just feels not natural process, yeah.
Okay, I'll answer about this issue, and you can come back if I'm not exactly answering your question. So when I say the aim is non-grasping, it is a practical aim, because the aim is nirvana, if you wish, or cessation of suffering. But the practical aspect of our technique of meditation is that the mind does not grasp. And when there is no grasping, then there is cessation of suffering. Just to be precise there, one would not say the aim is non-grasping, but the purpose of the technique of meditation is non-grasping. And the aim is cessation of suffering, or the cessation of conditioning. Just to precise that. Now about the the coolness that then one may fear that may happen if there is non-grasping. Then we just have people very non-grasping, that will be fine for themselves, but actually not so interesting people that we say that he is non-grasping there, that, you know, just let him. There's no use to go to him. It's not really somebody nice to connect with. Well, I see different aspects to that. I'll take one way of explaining that when the mind is not grasping, there is a quality of love and kindness which naturally will happen. It's not that there's notion of being cold and without grasping will be just lifeless. Because a grasping that you seem to imply is required for love and kindness, then that will create a relationship which will not be completely open for a true love and kindness and compassion. The grasping will be what prevents it. So when one is practicing metta, love and kindness, or compassion, one tries to bring the condition to clear away one attitude which is within ourselves. It's not artificially to create it. I'm not forcing. Let's imagine I take somebody neutral, I don't care. And that I'm not going to force myself, you know, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, that I'm going to force, I don't care, but may you be happy, may you be peaceful. It's not this way. The way it is practiced, that we take a situation where naturally our love and kindness will arise. Just naturally somebody we feel close to, and we are attached to deeply, and this situation will bring the sense of love and kindness naturally. Because our first reaction is usually the one of jealousy, of competition. That's our first reaction, is a reaction which is going to stop or block what could be the natural love and kindness to happen. In our daily life, most of us, due to habit and fear and so on, we react often with desire, aversion, jealousy, pride, and not with love and kindness. If you wish, the first reaction is usually one of these types. Now when we take a situation and see that naturally this person is bringing this sense of love and kindness, till we really feel it within ourselves, then we may try to bring another person, and that love and kindness feeling may stay, because it's not depending on the person who is arising. Is an unconditioned love and kindness does not depend on the person. It depends on the state of our mind. You see the difference? Otherwise, normal people as we are, somebody come, we like this person, so there is kind of kindness and we are glad, and another person we don't like and we are upset. There is no freedom. We don't choose what to feel. It's just a conditioning. Now developing love and kindness is a way that we will not be conditioned by the person. And we will develop that in a sense that we'll be able to see all the beings with the same amount of love and kindness. And this is also in the sense of freedom. Because seeing, wishing other people to be happy, having this feeling of love and kindness, that is a free feeling. It's not going to bind us. Well, the feeling of hate and ill will, that is binding us. That may lead us to action. That may lead us to words or to action which may be harmful. And not a free action. So we are developing in metta practice or karuna, love and kindness or compassion, a way of seeing the people in the world, not depending on what we imagine are their quality of virtue or their bad aspect. In this sense, we connect to this quality which is within ourselves, and by this strong connection, this will be the way that we see the people before this reaction of jealousy, hatred, or ill will, of competition will arise. So that will be the way. And this opening of the heart, and in this opening, there is also loosening of the grasping. If you see somebody is coming and you have really a nice feeling, may you be happy, is very different than if this person is coming in and there is hatred, where the grasping will be much stronger. So this opening of the heart and mind, that will help the practice of vipassana. As you said, in practice of vipassana, sometimes some people have good concentration, But the mind becomes, in a sense, too narrow and doesn't deal in a balanced way with what I'm writing in the meditation. And that, where the practice of metta, which is done at maybe one sitting or different time, that will bring the balance, that will not, one will not be stuck with a mind which is too hard, but one will be open. So they are usually practiced in a balanced way, often that one will do things for period of time, doing vipassana, and then metta, and then maybe come back to vipassana. And the teacher in different traditions, monasteries or centers, they would suggest to one student, maybe it will be good for you to do a period of metta practice, because that's what you need now. You have developed the other one, and it seems that, like in meditation, sometimes when it's slightly stuck within one attitude, one has done, and it's kind of does not really, is not alive anymore. Because maybe one needs slightly more opening, then one may bring the metta practice. And after some time, the metta practice has been developed, one may come back to vipassana. And in this way, one can balance them. Did I answer some part of your question? Is there other aspects that you would like to?
Thank you.
Okay. Yes? So what is the question? How not to cling to the... Okay, we will speak just before the people leave, either tomorrow with the people leaving tomorrow or on Saturday, about how to bring our practice in our daily life. So there may be this clinging for many of us to the peace that we may meet in a retreat. And that may not be the most important problem in our practice. I'll tell you why. Because maybe that also what leads us to come back to retreat. You know, and there is some kind of thing that in a sense I can learn something and develop something, then one keep on doing that. I remember I had a teacher of meditation who said, you should stop the session before you are too tired, so you feel like starting again. If you were to do a retreat till you are really exhausted, you say, I don't want to meditate anymore, it's the end, then he was thinking that that's not the best, because then you don't want to start again, never. Well, if you, when you stop, you feel, oh yes, maybe there was something nice or interesting and I could see that it can be alive, then one would start again. It can be during the day, for example, in our daily life or whatever, if we were to sit in the morning and make it so long that we are really exhausted at the end, we say, I'm so glad that it's the end, and that may be too long. For example, in our daily practice, one may maybe make it shorter, that when one stops, one feels still fine, and not that we are completely disgusted with our meditation. So that's one aspect. But we'll speak about how to try to combine that in our daily life. Yes, and there must be some possibilities. I want to speak a bit more about that also, to come to some element of your question. I've spoken to a few authors here about one teacher, and she is teaching now since a few years. She was a single mother with three boys, and she had no time to sit in a home. There was no way that she could even take 10 minutes. And the teacher that she met explained her how to be mindful while doing the dishes and cleaning the apartment. And she developed the complete insight through this practice. And now she's teaching, so it means that she could use her daily activities for the practice of meditation. She had a job, certainly she was as busy as most of us are, but she had a strong determination. So there is some way to bring mindfulness into our daily life. Mindfulness is nothing very special, actually, is to do completely what one is doing. What is strange is that one needs to learn it. As a human being, it's something that should be natural. It's not some weird kind of activity, it's a way of doing things. It seems the most natural. And the second question? Okay, those three moments or steps that I spoke of last night, it's not that one chooses, I see that and I see that and I see that. It's usually, first one is completely concerned with the contents of one's thoughts, you know, oh that's interesting and I will do that and I do that. And then suddenly the mind becomes slightly more clear and more quiet, and one sees, oh that's just thoughts. It's not that, oh no, I choose, no, I want to see this just thought. There is a quietness and more power of mindfulness is slightly stronger. Then I say, oh, that's just thinking. And one starts to be aware of the process. And now when the mind becomes even quieter, then one starts to see that, oh, this is just changing and changing. It doesn't mean that the mind should be in a very most deep peace. Sometimes one can see this changing aspect of the mind, even when the mind is not very concentrated. Some aspect is striking us for some reason. You know, maybe when one was clinging to something and suddenly disappeared, say, well, that's strange. Oh, I can't just cling to it because it goes away immediately. It's not really when he's choosing to look at one or the other, it's by the connection with the experience that one aspect appears in a clear way. One is not looking for it, because if one is looking for it, one is looking for it with a concept, and that means that one may be cheating oneself. To be mindful, yes? Not to look for those things. Otherwise, it means that what we will realize is just what we thought will be the truth, and we cannot trust it. Then we can read books, but to come to the experience that the light will come from the experience itself. Yes?
What would be the difference between reflection, not thinking, reflection, and insight? It seems very subtle, you know, that when it's reflection, it should not be carried on, and insight, which just naturally comes, is there.
Yeah. What you mean by reflection?
Reflection is, I think, when you stop suddenly, you feel very much like insight, but I just don't know exactly. In the tradition, I understand you should have reflection and you should not reflect too long. It's like when you come to a philosophical conclusion, but it's not thinking, you know, you feel it's the truth. And yet it's sort of slightly different than insight. I don't know, maybe.
Well, I don't know about the sense of reflection. What I would say, in connection to what you express here, is that when insight appears or arises, it's a direct experience. And then, after that, one may put word on it. The concept may arise. But it's still very different, and the power of transformation or of deconditioning is much stronger with the experience itself, which is insight, rather than with the concept that may arise after that. You know, I'll come and say, oh, I've seen or experienced impermanence very, very clearly in my sitting, but now I still have a sense of duration, but I remember that was clear. Now I am holding the concept of it. Exactly like if you are in holidays by the sea and swimming, and then you are in your home and you say, I had beautiful holidays. Although the sea was fantastic and the water was very nice. So it's very different when you are in the water with the temperature of the water and all the, of course, the qualities, when you remember. So here there's a difference with the experience, just the experiencing of things changing, and then the concept that may arise afterwards, that is impermanence, that is changing. And the danger may be to cling to the concept in impermanence, and then one comes to the sitting and one wants to experience it, so one keeps the concept in mind rather than just open to the experience, and whatever may arise again. So there's slightly different there. Yes.